Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello, and welcome to As It Is, a free, daily, 30-minute program designed to help you learn everyday American English. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz at the Voice of America's Learning English Branch in Washington. Today on the program, we will tell you about how government agencies are partnering with private groups to improve the grasslands of the Great Plains of the United States.
Once it's bitten, no matter how far down it's eaten, if it starts to regrow, we move the animals away until it has regrown.
Then, as always on Mondays, you will hear Jonathan Evans' technology report. This week, he tells us about a program that provides free solar panels to poor people in Washington, D.C.
I'm very excited. My electric bill has really dropped. The last few months has been like $40 a month.
And as we do every weekday, we will present The Making of a Nation. Every day here at VOA Learning English, we bring you news from and about America and the world. And we tell you the often surprising and always interesting history of the United States. We're on the radio, on the web, and we come to you on a podcast. We are wherever you are. We're the Voice of America. Grasslands cover one-third of the Earth's surface. Grasslands are known by many names, such as savanna, prairie, steppes, or the plains. The health of grasslands depends on how much animals graze on the native plants. If too many animals feed on the plants, the area could become a desert. But too little grazing can also be bad for grasslands. The Great Plains covers a large area in the middle of the United States. A lot of it is grasslands. The Great Plains are west of the Mississippi River and east of the Rocky Mountains. The area includes parts of 10 states. The Great Plains are known for supporting large cattle ranches. A growing number of environmental groups are joining with local ranchers to improve the health of grasslands and make their businesses more profitable. That is the sound of the wind blowing native grasses in Niobrara Valley of Nebraska. Steve Hicks directs the Niobrara Wildlife Refuge for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. One of its goals is to protect native plants and animals.
The habitat diversity here is really pretty incredible.
Songbirds, small animals, elk, deer, and American bison live in the grasslands.
The bison are part of our purpose here at Fort Niobrara Refuge, and we're supposed to provide a good habitat for them.
300 years ago, 20 million bison lived on prairies that covered most of what is now the American Midwest. The bison traveled thousands of kilometers each year, seeking food and fleeing other animals that hunted them. Their grazing helped the grasslands stay healthy. Their waste also helped the plants grow. And because the bison did not stay in one area for very long, grasslands had time to recover. Today, the country has only about 30,000 wild bison. They mostly live in fenced-in areas on public land. Fort Niobrara raises 350 bison on 9,000 hectares. Steve Hicks says, it is not easy to control the large animals.
And bison are manageable, but it's a lot bigger job to keep bison contained than it is cattle. They'll go just about where they want, if they really want to.
The Fish and Wildlife Service also lets cattle ranchers use about 25,000 hectares of the government's land. One recent day, rancher Bob Grabher and a few other men were moving about 500 cows and their calves. The men were riding on small vehicles near the bison. They used a combination of methods to get the animals out of a 200-hectare fenced pasture where they have been grazing for a few days.
The refuge sets it up and gives you what pastures you will be in and how many days you're in each pasture.
The Niobrara Wildlife Refuge asks ranchers to graze their animals on the grasslands as the wild bison did hundreds of years ago. So Bob Grabher's team moved the cattle to another fenced area that hasn't been touched for 3 years. Dean Churchill is Mr. Grabher's son. He said that the ranchers can raise more cattle because they are able to lease land from the government. The animals never graze a pasture continuously, but the ranchers often let them stay in one area for 2 weeks. And instead of letting a pasture rest for years, they often bring cattle back within a few months. Mr. Churchill said this can help improve the grass.
It adds compaction to the soil. The footprints within the soil allows the moisture to penetrate the soil better.
Mr. Churchill says he learned these planned grazing techniques 20 years ago from Alan Savory. Today, the Savory Institute trains ranchers around the world to use planned grazing. The Institute's Byron Shelton says it is important for ranchers to know when to move their cattle.
Once it's bitten, no matter how far down it's eaten, if it starts to regrow, we move the animals away until it has regrown. And that way we have the roots being the strongest they can to hold soil, hold water, make the ecosystem function.
The environmental group Nature Conservancy works with the Savory Institute. William Burnage is Nature Conservancy's Colorado Grasslands Program Director. He says a 3-year-long experiment showed them how to graze more cattle and create a more diverse habitat.
And at the same time, we've improved the financial outcomes for ourselves and for our lessee at the ranch, and his quality of life, I think, has credibly improved.
Now, it's time for our weekly look at the latest technology news. Solar panels are an increasingly common sight on the tops of homes in wealthy parts of Washington, D.C. But now, the costly technology is moving into a poorer area of the city. and the people who live there are getting the panels for free. Our technology correspondent Jonathan Evans tells us more.
Southeast Washington, D.C. is an area known more for low-income housing than new technology. But several homes in Southeast now are topped with solar panels. Tila Felder is among those who have received solar panels for her home. She praised the lower energy costs.
I'm very excited. My electric bill has really dropped. The last few months has been like $40 a month.
Renee Carr, I'm a former AMC commissioner at ABL6.
$200 a month.
Local officials make these solar panels available to residents whose yearly earnings are at or below $50,500 for a family of three. A family of four can make up to $60,000 a year and qualify for the panels. Ted Trebu is with the local government program, DC Sustainable Energy Utility. He says they plan to put solar panels on hundreds more homes.
We'll do about 135 this year. Next year, the goal is 200. We've been able to hit our goals every year for the last 4 years. In the years after that, the funding looks secure. I see no reason why we shouldn't be able to do more like 250 homes.
Atta Karash installs solar equipment. He says he will set up as many as 1,200 solar panels this year. That is not a high number compared to states like California. But Mr. Karash and other Washington officials believe the number of installed panels could double by 2016.
Most of the time, most of our clients hear us through word of mouth, through other jobs we've done in the past, or through existing clients. And what they do is they reach out to us, and we do the income qualification, and we come out and do a site visit, make sure that they qualify. And then if they qualify, we just put them on our construction schedule, and we get the job started.
The program is paid for with fees from factories and oil processing centers for their carbon dioxide emissions. Government officials expect millions of dollars in savings as the solar panels become more popular. They believe energy subsidies to poor families will be cut and electric costs will go down. They add that new jobs will be created. Edwin Amaker also lives in Southeast Washington. He is pleased with the 16 new solar panels on his roof.
Well, I was told that I would save between 30% and 40%, which is major, you know, when you start talking about the price of energy nowadays. So I like that. The less money in my pocket, the more money I have for the family.
Washington officials hope to start a program next year to help small businesses install solar panels on their buildings. They hope to turn the nation's capital into an environmentally clean solar city. I'm Jonathan Evans.
Thanks, Jonathan. Well, that's our program for today. We hope it has informed you and entertained you and has helped you learn everyday American English. We want to hear what interests you. Tell us what you want to hear about, and you may hear stories about your interests on a future As It Is. Our email address is learningenglish@voanews.com. That's learningenglish@voanews.com. The Making of a Nation is coming up next. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz, reporting from the VOA Learning English headquarters in Washington. We'll be back tomorrow at this same time to help you learn everyday American English with another broadcast, webcast, and podcast edition of As It Is from the Voice of America. Thank you.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation, a weekly program of American history for people learning American English. I'm Steve Ember. Last time, we talked about the Amistad case. The Amistad was a slave ship from Cuba. In 1839, it appeared off the eastern coast of the United States. The Africans on the ship had killed white crew members, including the captain. They demanded to go back home to Africa. But the two remaining slave traders on the ship secretly sailed the Amistad toward the United States. The U.S. government put the Africans in a low-security prison in New Haven, Connecticut, and it made plans to take the Africans to court. A judge would decide whether the occupants of the ship were slaves who had rebelled, murderers, or captives who had been kidnapped from their homes. The Amistad case brought attention once again to the issue of slavery in the United States. At the time, slavery was legal and an important part of the country's economy. But the U.S. and several European countries had banned the international slave trade. A small group of activists wanted to totally end slavery. They believed slavery was a sin. But in the 1830s, most Americans did not support these anti-slavery activists known as abolitionists.
Most Americans, first of all, were racist, and secondly, saw these people as utter fanatics who were intent on destroying the Union.
Julie Roy Jeffrey is a professor of history at Goucher College in Maryland. She says newspapers reported on the Amistad case, and people began talking about slavery and the slave trade. Slowly, some Americans' feelings toward the abolitionist movement and enslaved Africans changed.
For example, there was a play put on in New York City called The Black Schooner that was based on the Amistad incident. And there were many, many people who went to see it. It became a popular event. And wax figures of the captives were exhibited in various places in the United States, and artists drew pictures of them.
The abolitionists wanted to make more Americans sympathetic to the Amistad Africans. They found lawyers to represent them, paid tutors to teach them, and organized outdoor exercises to keep them healthy and visible. Howard Jones taught history at the University of Virginia. He says one of the most popular members of the Amistad Africans was an 8-year-old boy who had learned English. The boy told the public about his life in Africa and about the conditions on the slave ship that brought him across the Atlantic Ocean. The Amistad case also was increasingly becoming a political issue. People wanted to know what President Martin Van Buren was going to do about the case. Historian Howard Jones says Van Buren found the position difficult. He did not want to anger Southern voters who supported slavery and wanted to make the African slave trade legal again. He also did not want to anger Northern voters who believed the Amistad Africans had been mistreated.
Van Buren did what any good politician would do, and that was to try to dodge the issue, stay away from it. He couldn't understand why 40-plus, by this time, black people should affect anything happening in high political society.
But the Amistad issue would not go away. The case began in a circuit court. After 3 days, it went to a district court. The district court judge ruled that the African slave trade was illegal under international treaties. For that reason, the Africans were wrongly taken. President Van Buren was worried the decision would cause more political problems for him, so he ordered the nation's highest court, the Supreme Court, to hear the case. The Chief Justice of the Supreme Court at that time was Joseph Story. Story did not like slavery, but he did not support the abolitionist movement either. He thought its ideas opposed the rule of law. The abolitionists had good lawyers, but they knew they needed more help arguing their case in the Supreme Court. So they turned to former President John Quincy Adams. At the time, Adams was a congressman, not an abolitionist. But he led a campaign against an 1836 rule restricting anti-slavery petitions. Adams said the rule was a violation of the constitutional right to petition Congress. Historian Julie Jeffrey says the 1836 gag rule, as it was called, helped the abolitionists' cause.
It became partly a freedom of speech issue, not just about slavery, but about the rights of citizens to speak out and to be heard by their representatives in Congress.
Yet John Quincy Adams was not excited about arguing the Amistad case. He was 72 years old, nearly blind, and very busy. But the issue of the Amistad Africans troubled him. Howard Jones says Adams believed capturing people and enslaving them was immoral, especially in a country like the United States. In the end, Adams agreed to defend the Africans.
And he makes the argument in the court case that we have the Declaration of Independence right there on that wall, and that says that life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, it doesn't say for white people only or anything like that. He was arguing, trying to argue, that it's something that's available for everyone. It's part of the justice system.
Chief Justice Joseph Story did not totally accept Adams' argument or suggest that any kind of slavery was wrong, but he did agree with the district court that these Africans had been taken illegally from their homes. They were not and had never been slaves, Justice Story said. They were free people and should be returned home. So in 1841, the remaining 30 or so members of the Amistad captives got on a ship called the Gentleman and returned to West Africa. Howard Jones says the incident was the only time he knows that black people who had been brought to the New World as slaves actually made it back home.
And how they do it? By winning in the American court system. This was just unheard of. But the decision was basically that it doesn't matter whether you are black, white, purple, green, or whatever color you are, you have been kidnapped. And so therefore you have, and Joseph Story said this in his decision, which really opened the door for a lot of arguments, that under the eternal principles of justice, you have the inherent right of self-defense, even if you must kill your captors.
Howard Jones says the Supreme Court decision also gave the abolitionists a new sense of power.
And the abolitionists immediately printed pamphlets, leaflets, had talks, everything they could to show that these people went free, and their implication was this is what's going to happen to slavery itself, that this is a great victory for the black man.
But the Amistad case did not really change the situation in the United States for most black people. Many were the children of slaves and could not argue that they had been kidnapped from Africa. And it was still legal to trade slaves across U.S. state borders. The Amistad case also did not solve all the problems in the abolitionist movement. Julie Roy Jeffrey says during the trials, many abolitionists worked together, including blacks and whites.
It sometimes worked very well, and it sometimes didn't work so well, but it was certainly one of the first times that blacks and whites had worked so fruitfully together.
After the Amistad victory, though, the abolitionist movement broke into different groups. Ms. Jeffrey says some black abolitionists wanted more respect from white activists. Other abolitionists just had different ideas about how best to end slavery, by trying to change the country's laws or by appealing to Americans' moral sense of right and wrong. Abolitionism did influence other movements, however. One was the missionary movement. Julie Roy Jeffrey says Christian missionaries had already been going to Africa, hoping to persuade people to follow their religion. But the Amistad case and abolitionism made more people want to share their beliefs with others. Some missionaries even converted the Amistad captives to Christianity and returned to West Africa with them. Ms. Jeffrey says the abolitionist movement also helped create the women's movement in the middle of the 1800s. She says most 19th century white women mainly cared for their families in the home, but women abolitionists played an important public role.
They weighed in on the most political question of the day. They took on activities like collecting petition signatures and raising money and giving speeches.
As a result, Ms. Jeffrey says, some women came to believe they had a right to develop their own beliefs and have political power.
Sometimes they propped up their activism by appealing to things like the Bible. One woman I remember said something like, "I read my Bible and I know what it tells me." And she was opposing the minister in her church, and she was a very active abolitionist.
Yet, even if abolitionism still did not personally affect most Americans, it made an increasing number of people question whether they wanted slavery to continue. Next week, we will tell about the short presidency of William Henry Harrison. And we will continue talking about how slavery influenced presidents and politics over the coming years. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History from VOA Learning English.